Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. In my experience, particularly recently, I've been doing a lot of meditation with sound and listening, and I've found that over my long years of exploring various sensory and consciousness modalities, that meditation on sound and the experience of listening to music, listening deeply to music, and particularly to certain kinds of music, associated with drones and resonance and particular kinds of tactile spatial qualities, can really point to some of the deeper possibilities of consciousness and indeed bring our sensation to the verge of something that we might almost call the cosmic. I've had a number or a few particularly powerful experiences with music and listening and meditation. One time I was about 5 days into a meditation retreat, and just like the books say, I began to hear celestial music, a kind of distant sound of gongs and bells and other sort of nebulous sounds. And at the time, it was kind of funny because I was still writing a lot about music at the time. I'd been a rock critic for many years, and even though I was in the midst of this heavenly state, my little critical brain still popped up a comment. Well, that's pretty good. It's a little cheesy. It could be a little more. It could be a little more interesting. It was very very funny experience. And then there was another time I was listening to some music at a folk festival in Estonia. And the woman was playing a kanel, which is a kind of lap harp, or really a kind of dulcimer. The music was so transporting that something really new happened, something that I've only had happen a couple times in my life, where it wasn't the content of the music that was affecting me, and it wasn't even the vibration, the kind of physical sense of a vibrating or resonant world which changes your mind, changes your body, changes your spirit, but it was really more a sense of how music as such is a kind of, I don't know, pure or essential expression of the cosmos, that here we were, humans gathered together, playing with vibration as a kind of fundamental expression of our being. And I still really think of music and sound as being one of the key sites, and in some ways, one of the more accessible sites through which we can access these deeper domains of consciousness. And I was thinking about this canal, this wonderful sound of this Scandinavian instrument, because we're very lucky today on Expanding Mind to be speaking with Laraji, a musician probably best known for his zither playing, although he's made many different kinds of music with lots of different qualities in it. Laraji's most famous record is still probably the third ambient record that Brian Eno made in the late 70s and early 80s. He made four of these all marvelous albums that really helped kind of communicate the idea of ambient music about the same time at which people were also making music that came to be called New Age, or was starting to be called New Age music. So Brian Eno's ambient music and the emergence often on cassette of a kind of New Age music that was designed specifically to enhance meditation and states of consciousness kind of happened at roughly the same time, even though Eno wasn't particularly interested in the spiritual dimensions of these musics. And Laraji is kind of a bridge between these two worlds, as we'll find out more. He's been deeply immersed in the world of meditation and consciousness since the 70s, as well as making some extraordinary music. And we'll hear a little bit of from Ambient 3 later in the show. It happened out very nicely. Just a couple of months ago, I was buying records at my local Amoeba Records, and I had $28 in trade, and I was like, well, what am I going to get? And there I was wandering in the New Age section, and there was just an incredibly appealing collection of three cassettes in an orange package. And this was a reissue of some of Laraji's earlier cassette releases, so reissued on cassette, which was a fun thing for me, a somewhat nostalgic one. And it was, the music was extraordinary and brought me back into Laraji's work, and I've been listening to it since then. Another great source is Celestial Music, 1978 to 2011, which is a compilation put out a couple of years ago, highly worthwhile. But I would also urge you to go out and try to get a hold of this all-in-one-piece Laraji collection of cassettes. And so I'm looking forward very much to speaking with Laraji. Laraji, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. Wonderful hearing your wonderful delivery. You've said a lot in on one breath.
Well, that's what I aim to do in this show. See, pack as much in as I can in one breath. And I like the way you talk about breath too. You know, one of the things about music that really keeps me coming back to it in a spiritual way as well as a pleasure way is that it combines. You know, music has sound, harmony, melody, all of this kind of musical material, but at the same time, music is also sound. It's vibration. It's basic. It's
yes.
breath.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way that our speech has words and intonations and meanings and sentences, but it's also breath. It's also a kind of breath that we shape through our mouths. That's something more essential even than words. And music can be sometimes even more essential than music. And I feel like your music both comes from that place and helps bring people to that place. I wanted to start out to ask you about, I'm sure you've told the story a number of times now, but to talk about an experience you had in the early to mid 1970s. Okay. You're already a musician, you've studied piano, you're devoted to dancing, you love music. But you had a kind of an experience of a sort of cosmic sound, a kind of a extremely unusual experience of sound that when I read a description of it in one of your interviews, reminded me of some of these occasional experiences that I've had with a kind of sound that is more than sound. So I would love it if you could tell that story to get us started.
Yes, Eric, that was in the mid-1970s, and it was about three to 4 years after I had committed myself to getting my own relationship with meditation. So I dived into meditation and would open the meditation with several breaths and reading some things from either mind science or the scriptures, something inspirational. And I would also take off all titles that have ever been used for me. So I would be sitting in an easy chair, I'd do some breathing, do some inspirational reading, and then take off every title that had been ever used to relate to me. That would be take about 3 to 5 minutes, and then sit with what's left. And what was left is usually this non-anxiety, this non-rush, this non-weariness, this easiness about being right here as an eternal witness. So that was the basic kind of meditation I was doing around this time, and then I would sit for about 5 hours and just go deeper and deeper into the stillness. So one of these mornings before going into meditation, I had taken a long walk out near JFK Airport, and I came back to the house. The house was quiet. Everyone in the house was asleep. And as I was taking off my coat and making eye contact with myself in the living room mirror, I became aware of this sound music, the likes of which I never heard before, and it was a lot of volume, and I couldn't imagine anyone in the house upstairs playing this kind of music that loud. And the music was not the kind of music hearing experience that I was familiar with, of a sound originating somewhere in the distance and traveling along a linear path and arriving at my ear. This listening experience was more like as if I was an omnipresent witnessing ear and being aware of a sound that was everywhere at the same time, even beyond what I knew to be cubic feet or miles. So this all-immersive, all-embracing sound, I would guess best say it activated an emotional response in me of my heart cracking open for the universe, falling in love with the cosmos, with timelessness. The sound also either activated or it accompanied my expanded insights that everything in the universe is vibrating at the same time in the eternal now. So here's this experience of falling in love with the whole universe, having an emotional, psychological awareness of unity of the now. And so this most beautiful music, best I can describe it, was a layer of text, a textural layer of brass instruments, weaving this most glorious, celebrative, cosmic reunion kind of music. And there was no end to the music and no beginning to the music. I found myself grappling for an idea of how I could record this music or notate it. And all of this was going on in my head while being aware of this timelessness and this cosmic reunion kind of feeling. And after the experience, all I could do was just let it go. And the next day I went into town to the library at Lincoln Center and started doing research on sound and music to see if I could come up with anything that would relate to that experience. And sure enough, there was literature about this experience as it's related to in different cultures, primarily in India. The Sanskrit name for it is nadam, or sound vibration, inner sound vibration, cosmic music, the inner sound current, and came to even understand that in the Bible, in the beginning was the Word, that the Word originally referred to this sound current, this timeless vibration of the cosmos. About 2 months after that experience, I was guided to being in a pawn shop in New York, and an inner meditative friendly voice that beckoned me to swap my guitar for the auto harp in the window instead of just trading it for money. And that auto harp I took home and started tuning my favorite chords and hanging out with drones and pads on the zither, on this auto harp zither. And it took me a little while, maybe a month or two after that, to realize the connection between my being guided to using that instrument and that original sound hearing experience, which was and is a cosmic drone, a continuous, like harmonic horn sound pad, celebrating the eternity of the universe. One thing I like to say about that experience is each time I tell it, I remind myself and the listener that that experience never happened.
I love it.
And that the eternal nowness, there's no future and no past, but that is the teaching in this hearing experience. And so I cannot duplicate that music, but my being drawn to practice what's called Nada Yoga, listening to this inner sound current, so drawing me emotionally out of alignment with personal history and into alignment with my transpersonal story.
Well, that's one of the remarkable things about, let's call it ambient music or the kind of cosmic music that you make is, you know, if even if one were just thinking about it in very non-mystical terms, you know, if I play a track from, you know, Days of Radiance or I Am Ocean or one of your recordings, you know, I press play, it goes through my iTunes and the numbers are counting along. It's, you know, it's like any other track, a folk song, rock song. It has a beginning and an end on my computer. But the kind of music that we're talking about is music that once it starts, it already seems to have already started long ago. It has no, very rarely does it have a very discrete beginning or a really discrete ending, unlike a lot of songs that end on a crescendo or the final chord or, you know, the symphonic resolution. Instead, this music comes and goes. So even though on one level, it's just like every other piece of music, it has a beginning and an end, and I can count the seconds and I can put it on a cassette tape. But at the same time, the music itself draws me into a frame, a way of listening that already pulls me out of time in a sense. Yeah. And that's such an interesting move that you can kind of model timelessness or the now in something that still very much exists within time. It's like one foot in the world of time and one foot in the world of now. And your music really sounds like it comes from that place of being sort of in one, you know, in one world and also in the other world. And what I wanted to ask you about is when you first started experimenting with the zither, whether at home or whether going to playing out on the street, how much of a meditation it was for you in the sense of breaking down that boundary between time and timelessness through your playing?
It's definitely a meditation because my early explorations with that instrument were my playing out of doors on the parks and plazas, subway stations of New York City, in lotus position, getting into the ritual of setting up, maybe lighting incense where it was acceptable, and just running a few of my favorite spiritual quotes through my head and breathing and dropping into the zone, as it's called, and then letting that feeling of the zone be my lead sheet. I would use that experience and that altered sense of spatiality and unifiedness be what drove my improvisation. My music was always improvised and spontaneously performed so that the music would reflect someone who's in a state of meditative consciousness or is in a state of awareness that there's a bigger all-inclusive field in which the local situation is unfolding. Like the city of New York is unfolding during this rush hour. But in the midst of that, one can be in meditative focus upon a higher stream of nowness, an uninterrupted flow of tranquility. And my experiments with playing from those meditative still states while on a busy sidewalk in New York resulted in many listeners expressing themselves as saying, slowing down, forgetting what they were worried about, and that altered sense of time, which would stay with me even while I was packing up and leaving a particular spot in New York, that sense of timelessness, of altered sense of location was very common. It is still common in my music and recorded music performances.
You know, I want to ask you a little bit about New York City. I mean, I know you were born in Philadelphia, but you've been in New York for a very long time, albeit traveling a great deal as well. And when you talk about it, particularly in the 70s, you know, you think about New York in the 70s was a harsh place. It was a difficult place to live. You know, the city services were rough. There was crime. There was a sense of stress. But of course, it was also an extremely creative place, not just musically or artistically, but spiritually. That really many of our, you know, great spiritual artists and gurus and meditators and seekers came out of New York City, which is kind of, it seems almost paradoxical. But when I hear you talking, I actually get the sense I get a sense of the way in which, in some ways, it's actually not necessarily easier, but perhaps more powerful, more transformative to discover these places of timelessness in the midst of such a intense urban environment. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how New York, you know, you still live there. What is alive about the city and being a spiritual person in the city?
Well, the body was born in Philadelphia and then moved to New York by way of New Jersey in 1966. And I immediately found that the parks were a good place to chill. And when I eventually got into the practice of meditation, still sitting and dropping out of the linear flow of thought and just being with the pure mind of I am, became simpler and simpler with yoga practice, doing some yoga, because yoga would soften the breath, soften the body, and then usually the last hour and 20 minutes, the last 20 minutes after an hour and a half of yoga, usually drops the student into what's called a Shavasana posture, corpse pose. And there I would find that that was my model for going deep into deeper meditation. And I would use that Shavasana posture as a model for dropping into spontaneous Shavasana on my own, usually relaxing the body, and spending maybe 20 minutes to an hour on just like taking a coffee break, dropping into Shavasana, and also practicing a modified form of Tai Chi Chuan, which was for me being in the parks of New York and allowing the awareness to drop out of the head, out of the cranium area, and like an actor, pretend or act as though I'm looking out of my body from just below my belly button. And that would put me in touch with a different frequency and resonance of time, space, and energy. I would contact what's called the chi energy or the field and just move my body through the field creatively for 20 minutes or so. And that would take me out of the rush energy of the classic New York. So there was the parks, Tai Chi, walking in the parks, doing yoga, and also doing barefoot kinds of dancing, meditative dancing, which I still do, which is another way, because that moves the breath, and when you're moving, you avoid the sensations of being stuck in some place. You're moving, and you avoid the sense of separation from anything. So that was my early practice, and then along comes meditation through laughter, of letting laughter open the breath, soften the body, and drop one's mental space into uncluttedness and just be in that quietude after good laughter meditation release. And so
well, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. Very interesting of your laughter. I know that you sometimes teach laughter meditation workshops and indeed other kinds of workshops. One of the nice things about the all-in-one piece cassette re-release is that one of the cassettes connecting with the inner healer gives us a taste of some of your workshop style and the kinds of things you talk about. It's very very appealing. But the laughter one in particular is fascinating. I know very little about laughter meditation, but I also noted that you, when you first came to New York, one of the reasons you came was to try your hand at stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of thread of comedy that runs through this story, which you might not, you might not guess, given the sort of typical associations of New Age or spiritual music. Is there a connection between your interest in comedy as a expressive theatrical form and your sense that laughter is one of the routes towards a kind of spiritual transformation?
I guess I'm like so many individuals. I enjoy good laughter, and I enjoy seeing my friends and new friends laugh. In college, when I studied music on the side, I would do comedy and participate in talent shows and wherever there was an opportunity to do solo or comedy teamwork. I just spiritually enjoyed laughing and being in the presence of people laughing. When I came to New York to explore my gift with laughter and getting people into the laughter zone, started out looking at the bitter end and traveling around the New York hootenannies in the late 60s, early 70s, and eventually came to a book by Rajneesh, Osho Bhagwan Rajneesh. And in this meditation book, he suggested laughter as a way to go into meditation. And I was quite impressed because it was just shortly after my exploring getting into meditation and discover that laughter and meditation don't have to be two separate things. And I discovered through music improvisation, that laughter can be an improvisation as well. And it can take me outside of what I know to be my familiar laughter and discover new things about my body, being ready to be in the laughter zone through quiet laughter, quiet breath work. Certain kinds of body language represent a happy body. And that music, that laughter, after doing so much of it, I observed, just like music, it can be a performance art, a healing performance art, because of the contagious, infectious nature of one's own laughter, that one can use it either as a legitimate on-stage performance art as part of what they do on stage, or to use it as a healing art, to wear your laughter spontaneously in the public flow, and knowing how to summon one's laughter, and a laughter that vibrates the heart, that thumps the thymus, that vibrates the pituitary in the head, that vibrates the thyroid in the throat, that opens the lungs and the alveoli and opens the abdominal organs and gives them a good massage. So we're talking about developing a demonstrable laughter that one can use their laughter to open up other people's connection to their inner quietude, laughter, and joy. And so music, my experience with improvisational music is it's spontaneous. You breathe, use your body language, and you can sweep your inner imagination with your music so that your music carries the subtlety, the nuances of where you are or I am as an artist at the time. And so I'm discovering that laughter, similarly like mantras, can come from a place beyond the thinking mind and can communicate. A mind that's empty of linear density can communicate a field that's unified in resonance. In the same way I use music, drones and tones and harmonic pads to guide the listener's awareness out of a tense emotional body and into a fluidity, that laughter can be used in the same way that music and sound. So the sound of laughter has a lot of good information of light, of openness, of acceptance, of non-rigidity. And like music, it can be a messenger of a good place to be in your heart, a good place to be in your breathing, a good place to be in your emotional presence.
Well, that's wonderful. I have to admit, I was grinning throughout your whole explanation. I want to take a little break here just to play a little bit of your music. If folks are not familiar of it, we want to just play a short taste of the dance, which is, or one of the versions of the dance, which appeared on that record you made with Brian Eno in 1979. Brian Eno discovered, quote unquote, you in Washington Square Park. Your eyes were closed. You were following one of these improvisatory visions, and you opened them up, and there's a note from Eno saying, "Hey, get a hold of me." And you made this really wonderful record that I want to talk to you a little bit about, but yeah. Before we do that, I'd love to just play a little short bit from the track. So with the engineer's assistance, can we hear a little bit of the dance from Days of Radiance?
So I'll hold on here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
just a tiny little taste there, but the magic was already working. It also reminded me of times I used to listen to this record way back in the day, precisely to carve out some difference in the day, and often to end the day, putting on the record just before going to bed to just kind of clear the zone. One of the things you did with the zither that I wanted to ask you about early on is that you decided to start playing with electronics to see, hey, let's put a fader here, let's use an echo, let's start working with the combination of a sort of organic sound or a natural material sound and an electronic sound. What was it about the what was the inspiration that led you to go, hey, let's bring some electronics into the scene? Because the zither is very beautiful just as itself, and you were like, well, let's explore this. Let's find some new sounds. What inspired that? Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Oh yeah, now I can.
Yes. At the time that I was getting into the zither, and I was during the time that I was exploring deep meditation, I was also playing Fender Rhodes electric piano with a jazz rock band in New York called the Winds of Change. And at one concert, a band that preceded us was playing, a guitar player was playing, and I was hearing sounds that I'd never heard before from the guitar. And the leader of my band was explaining to me that was a guitar going through a phase shifter. So that's the first time I heard anything about creative electronics. And I said, wow, listen to that. I couldn't describe what I was hearing, but I knew a phase shifter was something I wanted to check out. So when I got into electric zither, auto harp, after the pawn shop experience of purchasing the auto harp, I started exploring my favorite chords into the open tune zither. And then I went into town to the music store, Manny's Music Store in downtown New York, and started to search for ways that I could amplify this instrument. And there happened to be an auto harp pickup on the market. I purchased it right there. And also, I was told that this would work with a guitar phase shifter. So I purchased my first MXR phase shifter 90, I think it was. And I took it home and with the orange box and plugged it into my little amplifier and started playing with phase shifters. And then eventually reverbs and delays and chorus pedals and flangers. And it kept opening up to where I am today. At first, I would work with portable pedals that I could carry with me. And that became my sound, using portable pedals in the studio. And it was Brian who kind of weaned me off of my portable pedals and to play just clear, straight, clean zither for the recording. And he put on some very high-end, subtle effects, Eventide harmonizer. And that was my first introduction into high-end electronic effects with the Eventide harmonizer. And so in the later years, I've been exploring, you know, as you make a little more money, you explore paying more money for your effects. At the beginning, the level was effects that would cost around $100, $150. Now you start exploring effects that will cost anywhere up to $200 to $600. They're still portable. But then I'll look at the rack-mounted effects that cost anywhere from $800 up to $4,000 that I never would carry with me, but I get to experience them in the studio. And so I'm always opening to new effects that will allow me to treat sound like a sound painting experience, an exploration through textures, and that would suggest worlds that my emotions have not been able to express before. So music is like that. It gives my emotional body a vehicle to go into places that I can't go without being assisted by music. And effects have allowed me to represent timelessness through delays and reverbs. Also, to make drones a sensual experience with phasers and flangers. So effects definitely help me to bring forth a creative sound making and listening experience that internally can suggest worlds within worlds, like phasers within phasers, flangers within flangers, to give expression to my original sound hearing experience of timelessness, of this expansive spatiality.
I love your description. And one of the things that really has struck me for a long time, it's been a longstanding interest of mine, as someone who's very interested in spiritual music, and particularly music coming out of the 1960s and 70s and 80s, how electronics, which we think of as sort of part of the modern world, part of the modern industrial world, the world of making technologies work, of keeping the lights on, et cetera, how electronics have become such an important site of cosmic experiences, how in some ways musicians like yourself and so many others have helped sort of show the spiritual potential or the sacred potential of electronics precisely mm-hmm. because they enable you to create new domains, play with time, play with texture and timbre. And so it's for me a kind of wonderful sign that that sacred music is not just about the old and the traditional. Of course, there are drones that go back thousands and thousands of years. In some ways, the drone of tambura has never stopped. It's always been happening, or at least it's been happening for thousands of years. But there's also kind of a new drone, or a 20th, 21st century drone, a different turn of the wheel, an electronic turn of the wheel. I'm wondering how you, as a spiritual person, as someone who looks at the world through the lens of sacred teachings, of ancient traditions, how you have kind of come to think about electronics and effects and all of this gear, running on, electrons flowing down wires as part of the sort of story of sacred music.
Wow, yes. My insight is that given the artist, the musician, the composer, the sound maker, what they do with their life, their lifestyle, what they do with their life 45 minutes before playing or recording will reflect itself through their performance, through their art form. And as I say, a yogi who spends a large section of their day, I think a real spiritual person will give at least 10% of each day to inner work and to reaching into their divine identity. And that much time, I discovered even as a piano student at Howard University, which was required to give 5 hours of your day to your practice in the practice room, that your art draws you into a zone where your subject begins to ooze out of you. And so let's say a yogi or a disciplined meditator or a seasoned spiritual athlete, what their focus is will expand within them, within their nervous system, within their emotional self-identity, and it will express through whatever they do, even if they beat on an oatmeal box. And I'd say that a yogi or a meditative person exploring and finding a vocabulary in electronic music, there expression in electronic music can't help but to reveal their propensity toward stillness, quietness, a sense of a unified field. And the use of electronics will be their vocabulary. And the vocabulary will, if they've mastered the vocabulary, it can't help but express spiritual insight, spiritual values, a sense of meditation or a meditative understanding. I could put it like that, that a meditative understanding would be brought into electronic music use by the artists if they are exploring connecting to their meditative identity, their transpersonal self. It's not about can you use electronic music and make spiritual music with it. It says, are you a spiritually centric person when you come to your art form, when you come to your media? I'll say that it can't help but reveal itself through however you use and employ electronics.
Ah, that's wonderfully put. You know, and I wanted to ask you, you know, in a way, just I'm not a question of advice exactly, but one of the things looking at your history is, you know, you've been a spiritual practitioner for a very long time, and you've seen different teachers. You know, you Sri Chimnoy, Satchitananda, Sri Brahmananda Sarasvati. You know, you've been in different scenes. You've explored different tools and techniques. I'm curious how it's been for you in terms of the tension within spiritual practice between groups, whether they have, you know, whether that means you're interested in a particular teacher, then there's a group, there's a teaching, there's a place, there's a scene with all of the interpersonal dynamics on the one hand, and on the other hand, there's the fact that at the heart of it, there's still you, just you, doing your practice with or without the inside or outside the context of other people, at least in the, you know, conventional sense of practicing. And I'm curious, in your life, how has that gone? Have you gone through phases where you're very much part of community and other phases where you're very much pursuing your own practice? Did the strength of your own practice come really more from your own, like, artistic motivation or the singularity of your own vision? Or was it really dependent, at least at certain points, on relationships with teachers or relationships with particular communities?
Oh, well, to answer that question, I would say that my first teacher and the first community experience was the Christian Baptist Church in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, and that the model, the person who held the space for the potentiality of the spirit individual connecting to source consciously, was that model was presented to me in the teachings of Jesus the Christ. And so as a child, I absorbed those stories, and I would my prayers were to Jesus, and I would feel like after speaking to Jesus that I had spoken to a master psychotherapist, because whatever I couldn't say in those prayers was, I felt, what got communicated. So my first gravitation toward a figure, a teacher, a model that represented to me a connection to the divine was the image of Jesus the Christ. And over the years, that image shifted because of all the information that seems to be coming out as to whether Jesus was black, whether he was Jewish, did he have curly hair, did he play the auto harp? So I said, by that time, all the damage had been done. I had my optimism had been encouraged, and by that time, I believed that, one, there is this something that drives people to label it a god, and that one can walk around in consciousness and feel intimately in union with that invisible force. So after that, my exposures to and my interactions with Jesus in my heart kept me open to exploring metaphysics and mind science and unity and shamanism and altered states. And during that, I found that it was easier to not get hardwired into any one particular group. Mind science and Christian science, I discovered that when I sat in a congregation, I could read and I could hear pieces that I need to help me put my puzzle together. But I didn't feel comfortable about hardwiring myself into a particular group. I felt I want to be free to move through the world and listen and read and pick up information. And so there were groups that I would frequent more often than others, and like the Rajneesh people and Osho Rajneesh, I found myself doing meditations, laughter meditations, chaotic meditations. And on the Hare Krishna, I found out that celebrating and feasting was joyous and good, and that being around Hare Krishna, they would just drill me with questions that would rock my spiritual belief system until I come up with honesty, what do I actually believe in? And then there was Sri Chinmoy, his group out in Queens, that was soft and spiritual and quiet and gentle, and that inspired me to take music as a vehicle of spiritual evolution more seriously. And all along this journey, I would go and sit with teachers, Krishnamurti, Muktananda, Satchidananda, these and more, and get what I needed, and then come home and practice and read. And I found that I felt more comfortable of going at my own pace and speed by not being hardwired into any one particular spiritual path. Practice yoga, and I could practice it without belonging to a particular spiritual organization. And I also interface with a spiritual family called Ananda Ashram up in Monroe, New York, and that I go there frequently, and I feel that I don't need to hardwire myself into a group at this time. I can understand where it would be necessary if someone's coming out of a rather tumultuous period of their life and they need to ground their awareness in a higher higher order, and they need a sangha, and they need a spiritual teacher to balance their being exposed to negative energy. But after a while, the teacher, all teachers that I've been around, says, now you go in, find your inner teacher, and follow that inner teacher. So I have always been watchful as to not try to feel comfortable about resting on an outer group or outer teacher for too long, that eventually I'll have to come back to the self inwardly, the cosmic self, and practice being without and above the sense of othernesses. So to answer your question, I'm loosely connected to groups and teachers, but I've found it spiritually more restful to come in and abide within myself.
You know, that's really wonderfully put, and I appreciate your answer very much, because for me, one of the ways in which I navigate my own version of that, coming into contact with teachings, with teachers, with practices, but also maintaining or returning to my own peculiar, singular, a course through the creative chaos of the cosmos. That one of the ways that I've been able to navigate that is through the place where spirituality and art cross, or spirituality and music cross.
Ah,
that
beautiful.
For me,
yeah.
You know, the teachings of a Rajneesh or a philosopher like Nietzsche or whatever, that those are as important as listening to your music, or listening to Bhagavan Das, or listening to Ravi Shankar, or listening to John Coltrane. That for me, it's sort of they're reminding you in a way that there is a singular, there's something unique about each person's expressivity that needs to be kind of honored. And I'm sure from the inside, from being a musician and from being a musician who puts music out that people listen to for spiritual sustenance, and then some of which is even designed to open up altered states or to open up different kinds of time and timelessness.
Yeah.
That you're in it. You're very aware of that.
Yes, using music to open up, I like what you're saying, altered states, to draw the emotional body out of the box of linear time and let the heart recall its ability to feel timelessness, to feel the expansiveness of this great thing, the cosmos. And the teachers that I've been around remind us that The cosmos, the stars, the constellations, the solar systems, the moons, these are all within us. Who we are beyond this body is an infinite field. And all of that is within us. And music can take the heart to experience this, where words and teachings can keep the sense of self in the head, in the logical sense of self, in the rational mind that has a little difficulty wrapping itself around something like the self that's perfect, the self that's infinite, the self that's all-pervading. Yet this is what the self is in the midst of its being in the world. It's wearing this suit of I am this, I am that. And music can and has, like drone music, secular or music of the Gospels, can get the heart to well up and break out of the box of linear time and reconnect to this I am presence, this pure, unformatted present moment where there is bliss. We don't have to go out and get blissful. I find that if we take off the titles, there's the bliss of pure I am, the self that has not been formatted by titles and names.
When you talk about titles, you mentioned that at the beginning of that being part of your meditation practice, at least back in the days. I mean, all of the labels that we might use, like I'm a man, I'm a Californian, I'm 47 years old, you know, is that what you mean by titles?
Yes, exactly. We wear those titles, and we wear them honestly and dutifully. And there's no particular point in the day where we say, okay, I'm going to take these titles off, except at happy hour. Happy hour, we take some of these titles off. But, the I am a doctor, I am a businessman, we wear those because that's what we're doing, and we get bills paid, and we follow our dreams, and we serve people through those titles. But in the midst of us wearing those titles, there is the self that is the I am before it's anything else, just the pure I am. And the quest is to get back to experiencing who is this pure I am and just being with that. That is the quest, the inner quest of how to trust the mind that isn't filled with content of thinking, and just witness, be still. And that's what Shavasana is, and meditation is, that's what still sitting is, and that's what music can do. Music can take the heart out of its allegiance to the rational mind. And just swim in the sustained present moment. This is music. Can warp time, can take the emotions out of linear time and just be here.
Yeah, it's interesting for me, you know, as someone who's followed the, you know, I'm very interested in history and how things come and go. And again, like this moment in the 70s when there was so much attention to spiritual music and the crossover with the altered states and experiences and moving into the new age scene of the 1980s. And of course, we're really in a kind of revival or resurgence right now. I mean, there's more attention, for example, to classic new age music. You know, people are looking at it as a genre to be resurrected and appreciated. And I that includes your music and some of the retrospectives and attention that you've gotten. But I think it's part of a larger sort of need. I mean, even as our, you know, history seems even more in our face now, and the times are very intense and things are changing so fast, there's so much time, you know, I'm meaning not time to be leisurely, but there's so much change, so many ticks of the clock, each tick is a shift almost. At the same time, there seems to be a corresponding demand or need for avenues towards a sense of timelessness, whether it's through physical yoga or whatever. Do you sense another kind of shift that's something is happening at our particular time right now, or has it been continuous for you, this revealing?
Well, in the new age of now, we've got the information highway, so more people have access to a lot of information at times of the days when they normally didn't, on the subway trains. So I would say that we have a lot of brothers and sisters around the planet filled with lots of information, and the question is, how do you dump it? How do you relax from it? So the quest for, or the job for the new age music, is to, like drones, music that takes the self above, away from the thinking mind. And for the creative, imaginative, new age musician, they know how to tap into their meditative understanding, their transpersonal resonant being, and use it as a resource to guide them in bringing forth a spontaneous music that will be escape for the brothers and sisters on the planet who need to get out of the thinking mind. And new age music has to address this. How do you get more and more listeners to spontaneously drop out of the thinking mind, drop out of the worry mind, and just drop into the moment of now? And you want to help people who don't have the next 5 years to find out how to get into meditative states. So the music should do it. In the technological age, you're competing with a lot of high volume of pop music and world music, and so that people have happy music, lively music, but they don't have access to an artist who knows how to drop the emotional system down and drop the breathing down and just be nowhere.
Well, you know, Larashi, we're going to have to break it off there. It's been a wonderful conversation, and thanks,
Eric,
so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
Thank you.
Peace. Folks, you can check out Larashi, L-A-R-A-A-J-I, blogspot.com, and we're going to go out today with another track, I Am Ocean.
Thank you, Eric. Happy eternity.
Yeah. Peace. Keep your minds open.
Bye.